clatter of missiles. The shields and the rounded helmets ring with their blows. The fray swells to a bitter climax. It was wild as the storm that comes from the west at the time of the rainy goat stars flailing the earth, or the gales that go racing seawards, pelting with hail, when Jupiter, terrible in the south wind, bursting the clouds above us, unleashes tornadoes of water. Pandarus and Bitias, sprung from Alcanor of Ida, reared by the dryad Iara in Jupiter's sacred wood, young men as tall as their native pine trees and mountains, these two, confident in their weapons, threw open the gate which their general had given them to guard, positively inviting the foe to enter the ramparts. While they, swords drawn, flaunting the plumes on their tall heads, stood just inside, to left and right, in front of a turret. So, by some flowing river, by the banks of the Po, it might be, or Athesis' genial waters, twin oaks stand, head in air, soaring up side by side, raising their leafy crowns into the sky, their tops dizzily nodding. The Rutuli, seeing a gateway open, made a concerted rush for it. But the next minute, Quirkens, handsomely armed Aquicolus, Tmarus the Impetuous, and Hemon the Scion of Mars, with all their detachment, were either routed and running away, or had laid down their lives right in that very entrance. Then did the hearts of the combatants kindle to fiercer rage. The Trojans, rallying, concentrated at that point, willing to mix it and make extensive sallies beyond their walls. Now, Turnus, who was fighting ferociously and creating havoc elsewhere on the field, received a dispatch. The Trojans, flushed with the losses they'd just inflicted, had thrown a gate open. He left the work in hand and, moved by prodigious anger, charged at the Trojan gate and those insolent brothers who fought there. Antiphates first, for he was there in the forefront, Turnus felled with a javelin throw. Antiphates, bastard son of Sarpedon, by a woman of Thebes. The cornelwood lance flew through the soft air, went home in the stomach just under his tall chest. The darkly gaping wound spouted a torrent of blood, and the lung it was lodged in warmed its iron point. Then Turnus slew Meropes and Erymas, then Aphidnus, then Bitias, whose eyes were blazing, whose mind was berserk, but not with a javelin. No javelin would have killed him. A heavy projectile came catapulted and screeching at him, travelling like a meteor. The reinforced bull's hide shield, the trusty cuirass and its two layers of golden chainmail could not withstand that weapon. Bitias' giant frame fell crashing. Earth groaned, and his mighty shield came clattering down upon him. That fall was like when a stone pier, constructed from huge shaped blocks of masonry, and built out into the sea in the bay of Baiae, near Cumae, collapses. The wall of it falls away, dragging a mass of rubble behind, slaps the water, and sinks to the bottom. The sea is all in a welter. Black sludge oozes up to the surface. That impact shakes to the core Prochyta and the bedrock of Inarimi, beneath which, at Jove's bidding, Typhoeus was buried. At this, the war god Mars lent extra courage and strength to the Latins, applying his sharpest stimulus to their hearts, but loosing the spirit of flight and panic among the Trojans. The Latins gather their forces, for now they can get to grips with the foe, and the god of battle possesses them. Pandarus, when he saw his brother laid low, and realized how the engagement was going, the momentous turn it had taken, putting his broad shoulders to the gate, with a convulsive effort swung it shut upon its hinges, leaving many of his comrades in desperate action outside the battlements. Others he locked in with him as they came streaming back, but fatally failed to notice the Rutulian leader amongst them. Yes, breaking into the settlement. He'd actually locked him in there, as bad as putting a tiger in with a helpless flock. At once, a new light blazed from the eyes of Turnus, and dreadfully clashed his armor. The blood-red plumes on his helmet quivered. His shield gave off bright shimmers like lightning. Aeneas' men, in sudden consternation, recognize that detested visage, those giant limbs. Now the immense Pandarus, burning with vengefulness for his brother's death, leaps forward and cries, "This is not the palace that goes with a martyr's daughter as dowry, nor is it Ardea, your native town, you're shut up in. This is an enemy camp, and you'll never get out of it, Turnus." But Turnus, quite unflustered, smiling a little, replied, "Come on, then, if you've courage enough, come on and fight. You can tell Priam later you met a second Achilles." He spoke. Pandarus summoned all his strength and hurled a spear, its shaft rugged with knots and the unpeeled bark. The winds received it. Saturnian Juno was there to deflect it from Turnus' body. The weapon stuck harmlessly in the door. "But you'll not escape this weapon I wield in my strong right hand. I'm not a man who misses or leaves his opponent a whole skin," said Turnus. Then, rising on tiptoe, he whirled his sword aloft and brought the blade down between his enemy's temples, splitting the young man's forehead and face in half, a hideous gash. There was a crash as the young giant came to the ground. Dying, he lay stretched out, his limbs unstrung, and his armor spattered with blood and brains from the head that was slashed in two and sagging away to left and right over each shoulder. The Trojans, panicking wildly, turned, scattered, and ran. And if only the conquering Turnus had had the presence of mind to break open the bars of the gate and let his own comrades in, that day would have been the end of the war and the Trojan nation. But he was fighting mad. The bloodlust drove him on against his adversaries. First he caught Phalaris and Gyges, whom he had hamstrung. Then, snatching up their spears, he hurled them at the backs of the fleeing enemy. Juno supplied him with strength and courage. Now he killed Halys too, and Phegeus, whose shield he pierced. And while the defenders fought on the walls, unaware of his presence, he killed Alcander, Halius, Nemon, and Prytanis. Lynceus came at him next, calling up his comrades. But Turnus, the rampart on his right, lashed out with his flickering sword and got him. His head, swept off by that one short arm blow, tumbled and lay at a distance, still helmeted. Amycus next, that mighty hunter, was slain. None was so adept as he in the business of impregnating the tips of weapons with poison. Then Clytius, son of Aeolus, and Cretheus, beloved by the Muses. Cretheus, the Muses' darling, whose heart was given for ever to song and the lyre, to plucking the tuneful strings, who sang for ever about war horses, battles, heroic deeds. When news of the losses their men were suffering came at last to the Trojan generals, Nicias and fiery Serestus arrived, to see their people scattered and the foe within the gates. So Nicias shouted, "Where do you think you're running away to? What other refuge have you? What battlements but these? My lads, is one man going to make such a killing all over the settlement? One man who is trapped in our ramparts and get away with it? One who has sent so many of our best to perdition? You cowards, aren't you ashamed? Have you no pride, no feeling for our distressful country, our ancient gods, and Aeneas?" Stung by his words, the Trojans closed up their ranks and stiffened resistance. Little by little, Turnus gave back from the onslaught towards the river, that part of the wall which the Tiber bounded. Made more aggressive by this, the Trojans pressed in on him, shouting and concentrating their forces. So will a crowd of men harry a savage lion with spears levelled. The brute, in alarm, backs away, murderous-minded, viciously glaring. His rage and his courage forbid him to turn tail, but equally, much as he'd like to, he cannot drive a path through those men with their weapons. Just so did Turnus give ground. He was in a fix, but his movements were quite unflurried. His fighting blood was on the boil still. Yes, even then he had twice gone in at the thick of the foe, driven them twice in headlong confusion all round the ramparts. But the whole garrison came running to form up against him. Saturnian Juno dared not lend him the strength to oppose them, not now, for Jupiter sent Iris flying down from on high with a very brusque command to his sister and consort. "There will be trouble if Turnus leaves not the Trojans' encampment." And so that warrior found his shield less sure to protect him, his sword-arm flagging. Volleys of missiles from every angle were snowing him under. The helmet upon his temples rang with incessant blows, its strong bronze cracked open by fusillades of stones, and the plumes torn away from its crest. His shield's boss could not stand up to the battering. Led by Nestheus, who fought like a fury, the Trojans redoubled their fire. Then Turnus was bathed in sweat, which ran, he had not a moment's breathing space, dirty and sticky all over him, and he panted heavily, sick with exhaustion. At last he hurled himself, full-armed as he was, at one leap into the river below. Its yellow tide received him as he plunged in, and bearing him up on its gentle waters, washed the blood off and restored him in high heart to his friends. Book 10. Now a new day threw open the halls of Almighty Olympus, and a council was called by the Father of Heaven, the ruler of mankind, to meet in his sky palace, where, from the heights, he surveyed all earth, the Trojan encampment, and the peoples of Latium. They passed to their seats in the great hall, and Jove it was who spoke. "Great heaven-dwellers, why have you reversed the decision agreed on? What is the meaning of such unruly contentiousness? I had forbidden that Italy should meet the Trojans in war. Do you brawl in spite of my veto? What agency has frightened this side or that into taking up arms and provoking a conflict? A time will come when it's right to fight. Do not be premature. One day, when barbarous Carthage shall open a way through the Alps, and roll a tide of disaster up to Rome's very towers, then will strife and hatred, then will all violence be lawful. Have done now. Give your wholehearted assent to the pact I've decreed." So Jupiter briefly declared. But golden Venus in answer spoke at some length. "Father, eternal power over men and men's affairs, what other power is there which I can now entreat? Do you mark how the Rutuli are exulting? How Turnus goes through the fray, charioted and conspicuous? How he speeds, puffed up with triumph? The ring of their ramparts no longer protects the Trojans. No! They are battling within the gates, on the high-built parapets of the earthworks, and flooding the moat with blood. Aeneas is far away, and knows nothing of this. Will you never allow the siege to be lifted? Once more an enemy threatens Troy town, this baby Troy, and a second army assails us. Once more from Aetolian Arpi is Diomed moving against the Trojans. I well believe I too am not done with being wounded, your child. Until then, this war of mortals will not be over. If it's without your leave and against your will that the Trojans made for Italy, let them expiate their sins and withhold your succor from them. But if they were following out the solemn commands of the gods and the dead, why is anyone now permitted to cancel what you have ordered and to rewrite their destiny? Need I bring up again the burning of their fleet on the shore of Eryx, or the suborning against them of the Storm King and his wild winds from Aeolia, or the mission that Iris was sent on? Now Juno is dredging up the underworld, a province hitherto unexplored, and has suddenly loosed Electo on the earth to spread delirium through the Italian towns. Empire means nothing to me now. That was something we hoped for while luck was with us. Let them you prefer to win be the winners. If there's no place on earth which your hard-hearted wife will ever concede to the Trojans, I implore you, sire, by the smoking ruins of fallen Troy, let Ascanius be released, unharmed from the battlefield. Oh, let my grandson survive it. Aeneas may be tossed on unknown waters, so be it, pursuing whatever path fortune has found for him. I ask but to preserve, to withdraw his son from the fatal fight. I possess Amathus, Mount Paphos, and Cythera, and a shrine in Idalia. Here let him live out his days, unknown to fame, laying down his arms. Command, if you will, that Carthage crush Italy, hold her down with supreme power. There shall be no opposition from Ascanius. What was the use in escaping the horrors of war, slipping out between the Argive fires, running the gamut of peril through seas and desolate lands, when the Trojans are still in search of a second Troy in Latium? Better, I think, to have settled amongst his own country's expiring ashes, upon the soil where Troy stood. Father, I beg you, give Xanthus and Simois back to my piteous Trojans. Grant them to tread out the doom of Troy a second time. Then Queen Juno, inspired by strong passion, spoke up. Why do you force me to break my profound silence, to tear the skin from my grief and expose it? Has any mortal man or any god compelled Aeneas to be the aggressor and attack the ruler of Latium? At the bidding of fate he came to Italy. Very well, though Cassandra's ravings it was that moved him. But did I ask him to quit the settlement or trust his life to the winds? To leave his camp and the focal point of the war in a boy's charge? Undermine the Etruscans' loyalty? Make trouble among the peaceful tribes? Was he driven to this treacherous policy by a god, or some ruthless compulsion of mine? How does Juno or Iris' mission come into it? Shocking, you say, that Italians should ring your baby Troy with fire, and Turnus should set foot on his own native soil. Turnus, grandson of Pilumnus, son of the nymph Venilia. Well, what of the Trojans spreading fire and havoc in Latium, oppressing a land not theirs, and driving off plunder, choosing whom they shall wed, and abducting betrothed girls from their lovers, pretending to offer peace while their ships bristle with weapons? You may filch your Aeneas out of the grip of the Greeks, stretching a veil of cloud, thin air, in defense of your hero. You may transform his vessels into as many sea nymphs. But if I help the Italians at all, that is a crime. Aeneas is far away, unknowing of this. Let him stay so. You possess Paphos, Idalium, lofty Cythera. Well then, Why do you meddle with hot-tempered folk who are spoiling for battle? Are you saying it's I who am trying to capsize the leaky cores of Troyland? I? Not the one who threw the pitiable Trojans to the Greeks? What started Europe and Asia rising in arms against each other? Whose thieving hand broke down their peace? Was I responsible for the Dardan philanderer ransacking Sparta? Did I give him weapons, or kindle a war with his lust? Then was the time to have feared for your people. Too late now you rise with unjustified grievances, spattering futile insults upon me. Such was Juno's plea. It got a mixed reception from the heaven dwellers, who raised a buzz like the sound in a forest when a wind is getting up among the branches, gustily, sulkily murmuring, warning sailors of gales to come. Then the Almighty Father, the first Lord of the universe, uttered. And as he spoke, the high places of heaven fell silent. Earth shook to its foundations, and the firmament was still. The west winds held their breath, the sea smoothed out its face. Now take my words to heart, and let them not be forgotten. Since it was not permitted that the Italians should come to terms with the Teucrians, and your dispute allows of no ending, this day, whatever the fortune each warrior has and the hope he pursues, be he Trojan or Rutulian, I shall make no distinction. Whether the camp is besieged through the destiny of the Italians, or a fault inherent in Troy, or the taking of bad advice. I do not exempt the Rutuli. The selfhood of each shall determine his effort, and how it fares. I am king to all, and impartial. Fate will settle the issue. By the stream of his Stygian brother, the banks where boiling pitch flows in a black maelstrom, he nodded, confirming his promise. The nod caused all Olympus to tremble. That was the end of the conference. Jupiter rose from his golden throne, and the heaven-dwellers escorted him to his own place. Meantime, the Rutuli pressed hard on the gates all round, doing great execution, encircling the walls with fire, while Aeneas' men were hemmed in behind their ramparts and had no hope of getting away. They stood, dispirited, helpless, in the turrets, and manned the ring of their walls with thinning forces. Asius, son of Imbrasus, Thymetes, son of Hicataean, the two Assarici, with Castor and aged Thymbris, were in the forefront. Beside them stood Clarus and Themon, the two brothers of Sarpedon, who came from mountainous Lycia. There, lifting a huge boulder, a sizable chunk of mountain, with a superhuman effort, is Acmon of Leonesus, a giant like Clytius, his father, and his brother Menestheus. With javelins and stones the defenders are fighting bitterly, shooting incendiaries and fitting arrow to bowstring. Among them, see, the Dardan lad, special favourite of Venus, and looking it, too, his noble head uncovered, Ascanius glows like some jewel set in yellow gold which graces the wearer's neck or hair. Like ivory, which an artist has inlaid upon boxwood or terebinth wood from Oricum, he shines. His hair is falling loose about his milk-white neck, and is gathered above by a circlet of pliant gold. Ismarus, you too, your great-hearted clansmen saw, as you steeped arrows in poison and fired with unerring aim. High-born Ismarus from Meonia, where they till fertile fields irrigated by the gold-bearing river Pactolus. Nicias was there as well, raised to the heights by the glory of beating Turnus off just now from the high-built ramparts, and Capys, from whom the town in Campania gets its name. So they were all engaged in the exacting struggle of war. And now, at midnight, Aeneas was ploughing the seas. On leaving Evander and entering the Etruscan camp, he presented himself before their king, told him his name and nation, the aid he sought, and the offer he brought. Acquainted him of the forces Mezentius had won to his side, and the violent reactions of Turnus, warned him what need there was for reciprocal trust if the king's own affairs were to prosper, and added a plea. Tarchon struck a treaty at once, joining forces with him. The Etruscan army embarked. Heaven was with them, and the fate's embargo lifted. Now they followed a foreign commander. Aeneas' ship led the line. On its prow were Phrygian lions, surmounted by Ida, most dear to the Trojan refugees, for a figurehead. Here was stationed the hero Aeneas, calculating the changeful factors of war. Pallas stayed close at his left side, inquiring about the stars by which they steered through the dark night, then asking Aeneas to tell his adventures on land and sea. Now, muses, throw Helicon wide, and inspire my poetry to speak of the host that followed Aeneas from the Etruscan shore upon that night, manning the ships which rode the seaways. Massicus led a squadron, sailing in his bronze-beaked vessel, the Tiger. His contingent, 1,000 strong, had come from Clusium and the town of Cosae. Their arms were a deadly bow and a lightweight quiver of arrows slung over the shoulder. Grim Abas came too, his whole detachment in glittering armour, a gilded image of Apollo gleaming upon his poop. Populonia had given him 600 of her sons, expert fighters all. Ilva had furnished 300, that isle so rich in mines of inexhaustible iron. Third came Asilas, a medium between mankind and the gods, a master at divining from the entrails of sacrificed beasts, the stars in the sky, the songs of birds, the presage of lightning. He hurried to war 1,000 spearmen in close formation. Etruscan Pisa, whose founders had come from the river Alpheus, had raised them for him to command. Then followed the handsome Astyr, confident in his charger and many coloured accoutrements. 300 more, who were all of one mind in their wish for battle, came from their homes in Syri, from the country around the Minio, the ancient town of Pyrgi and malarial Gravisca. I must not pass over Cinerus, most valiant leader in war of the Ligurians, or Cupavo, with his small force and swan's plumes waving above his crest, a symbol of his father's transformation, and thus a reproach to Cupid and Venus. The legend being that his father, Cycnus, in grief for beloved Phaethon, was consoling his sorrowful heart with song beneath the shady leaves of poplars, once Phaethon's sisters, when he took on soft plumage, yes, snow-white as old age, and left the earth behind and sang his way to the stars. His son was sailing now with a band of other young men, oaring onwards a great ship, the Centaur, which trod the waves in towering bulk, its figurehead threatening the water below with a huge rock, its long keel furrowing through the deep sea. There, too, was Ocnus, who'd whipped up a force from his native land. He, the son of the Tuscan River and the seeress Manto, founded the city of Mantua and gave it his mother's name. Mantua, rich in its forefathers, who were not all of the same stock. 3 clans it had, each clan ruling over 4 townships, with Mantua, by reason of its Etruscan blood, as the capital. 500 from here had taken up arms against Mezentius. They sailed in warships following a figurehead of the river Mincius, wreathed with the grey-green rushes of Lake Benacus. Orestes drove wallowing on, his 100 men tugging hard at the sweeps and thrashing the waves. The sea's face foamed as they churned it. His ship was the giant Triton, the sound of whose conch affrighted the dark blue water. Its dipping figurehead was the hairy trunk of a man to the waist, below the belly a great fish. The water foamed and gurgled under that monster's breast. So many of the chosen princes who sailed in 30 ships, cutting the sea with their bronze prows to the relief of the Trojans. And now had the daylight gone from the sky, and the gentle moon's night-riding horses were pacing halfway across the heavens. Aeneas, whose anxiety allowed him no rest, was doing a trick at the helm and handling the sheets himself on the ship's stern, when, in mid-passage, a marvel, an argosy of his own ones, came to meet him. The nymphs, the ships that kindly Cybele had turned into nymphs and bidden to have a divine power in the deep, came swimming up abreast, cleaving the waves, as many as once had been moored by their bronze beaks to the shore. From afar they knew the hero, and dancing wreathed around him. Cymodoce, the one who was most skilled at speaking, followed behind, and gripping the stern with her right hand, raised up her body, while her left hand silently paddled the water. Then she startled him, saying, "Are you on the alert, Aeneas, O heaven descended? Awake! Pay out the sheets! Run free! It is we, your fleet, your barks built from the pinewood of holy Mount Ida, but now we are sea nymphs. When treacherously the Italian attacked us with fire and steel, we had to hurry and break your moorings, though we hated to do it. All over the sea we've been looking for you. The mother took pity and changed us into what you now see, to be goddesses, living our lives in the deep. But your son, Ascanius, beleaguered within the walls and entrenchments, is heavily under fire from the furiously fighting Italians. By now, the Arcadian cavalry, with a stiffening of Etruscans, are at the rendezvous. Turnus is firmly resolved to prevent them linking with the besieged, to intercept and attack them with his own squadrons. Up, then, and when the dawn comes, order your comrades at once to be roused to arms, and take the invincible gold-rimmed shield which the Lord of Fire himself has given you. Tomorrow's light, these are no empty words I am speaking, do not suppose it, shall see the Italians slaughtered in great heaps." So saying, and dropping away, she gave the tall poop a push with her right hand, an expert propulsion. The ship fled over the waves faster than any javelin or wind-swift arrow could fly. The other ships crowded on speed when they saw it. Trojan Aeneas was mystified and astonished, yet the omen heartened him greatly. Gazing up at the vault of heaven, he uttered a short prayer. "O gracious Lady of Ida, Mother of the Gods, who rejoice in Dindymus, turreted cities, lions harnessed in couples, be now my guide in the battle. Be near and divinely prosper this omen. Be with your Phrygian sons, O Goddess, and bless them." No more did he say. But, even as he spoke, the returning day was streaming back in full flush of light, routing the darkness. Now, for a start, he ordered his men to ready themselves, their hearts and equipment, for combat, and to obey his signals. And now, as he stood high up in the stern sheets, Aeneas held his Trojans and their encampment in view. So he lifted his shield with his left hand and made it flash. The Dardans, upon the walls there, raised a great shout. Their fighting spirit revived at this new hope. Their fire was redoubled. So it is when under the dark clouds the cranes, flying back to the Strymon, announce their approach, and trail their bugling cries as they swim through the air ahead of the south wind. But Turnus and the Italian commanders thought it a strange thing until, looking round, they saw ships backing up to the beach and the whole sea one swarm of vessels running towards them. The peak of Aeneas' helmet was blazing, flame poured from its lofty crest, and the golden boss of his shield spurted huge flashes. It was as when on some cloudless night you see a comet glowing, blood red and ominous, or the fiery dog star rising, which glooms the sky with sinister light and carries with it drought and pestilence to suffering humanity. Yet the gallant Turnus' confidence was unimpaired. He reckoned to occupy the beaches before them and beat off the landing forces. He spoke to raise their spirits. He even rebuked his men. "This is what you have hoped and prayed for, to break them in hand-to-hand combat. Brave men have the very spirit of war in their hands. Let each of you now remember his wife and his home. Remember the great and glorious deeds of our fathers. We'll meet the foe right at the sea's edge while he's in a flurry, just disembarking, his foothold precarious. Fortune always fights for the bold." So Turnus spoke, then considered whom he should lead in this onset and whom he could delegate to carry on with the siege. Meanwhile, Aeneas was landing his men by assault gangways from the high sterns of the ships. Many watched for the backwash of a swell that had spent its violence, then boldly jumped into the shallows. Others slid down the oars. Tarchon, eyeing the beaches, noticed a point where no shoals were heaving and roaring with breakers, but the seas ran up and spread out over the shore, unbroken, and quickly changed course towards it, crying out to his comrades, "Now then, rise to the stroke! Row hard, my gallant lads! Lift the ships! Hurl them forward! Let's make a gash with our bows in that enemy land! Let our keel gouge out a trough for itself there! I don't care if the ship breaks up on the foreshore yonder, once we have got a grip on the land." As soon as Tarchon had shouted these words, his crews all tugged on the oars together and ran their ships in a smother of spray at the Latin shore until the bows were lodged on dry land and the keels wedged there, undamaged all except Tarchon's ship. This galley, striking a shoal, ran aground on the ridge of a treacherous sandbank, where she hung balanced a while, seesawing and slapping the waves, then broke her back, tipping out her crew into the water. Splintered oars and floating thwarts got in their way, and the waves' backwash sucked at their feet as they struggled shorewards. Turnus reacted with speed and decision, aggressively throwing his whole force at the Trojans, blocking the beach against them. Trumpets rang out. Aeneas led the assault on the yeoman ranks, an auspicious start for the fray, mowed down the Latins, and killed Theron, a giant of a man, who had had the nerve to attack him. Aeneas' sword pierced a joint of his bronze corselet, the tunic stiff with gold, and mortally opened his side. Next he slew Lycus, who had been ripped from the womb of his dead mother, and consecrated to Phoebus because, as a babe, he'd survived that perilous knife. Nearby, Aeneas put down to death tough Cisseus and huge Gaius, who were laying about them with clubs. No use to them now was the weapon of Hercules, though, nor their own strength, nor the spirit of Melampus, their father, who had been the companion of Hercules during all his difficult labours on earth. Now, see, while Pharus is boasting aloud like a novice, Aeneas hurls a javelin right into his bawling mouth. Sidon, too, the golden down of youth on his cheek still, poor Sidon, who'd come here to be with Clytius, his latest love, would have fallen pitiably to the Trojan's sword, and lain there, oblivious of all his youthful loves, his ruling passion, had not his brothers, the offspring of Phorcus, interposed themselves in a solid body. Seven they were, and seven spears they threw, some of which glanced harmlessly off from Aeneas' helmet and shield, while the rest were deflected by guardian Venus, so as merely to graze him. He now called out to his close friend, Achates, "Pile me up weapons here! Each one I throw shall find its billet in an Italian, each weapon that once on the plains of Ilium lodged in a Greek." Then, snatching up a great spear, he hurled it. That flying spear whacked through the bronze of Maeon's shield, shattered his breastplate, shattered the breast as well. Alcanor goes to support his brother, holds up with his right arm the tottering Maeon. A spear drives through that arm, and onward goes streaking still upon its bloody course, but Alcanor's arm is lifelessly dangling by the sinews from his shoulder. Now Numitor, pulling out the spear from his brother's body, aimed it at Aeneas. But this time it was not allowed to strike its target. It merely grazed the thigh of Achates. Now Clausus from Cures came up, all confident in his youthful physique, and hit Dryops under the chin. A long shot with a hardwood spear shaft, which went deep in, transfixing his throat and at one stroke depriving him of voice and life itself. So Dryops struck the ground with his forehead and vomited up thick gore. Clausus laid low as well, one way or another, three Thracians of the exalted line of Boreas, and three whom their father Idas had sent from their native Ismarus. Now Halesus ran up with his Oruncans. Messapus, the son of Neptune, renowned for his chargers, arrived in support. Each army strains in turn to dislodge the other. The battle rages on Italy's very doorstep. As in high heaven the opposing winds battle with one another, equal in strength and spirit, wind to wind, cloud to cloud, wave to wave, locked and unyielding. Doubtful the issue, one long thrust and counter-thrust, neither side budging. Just so did the ranks of Troy and Latium clash together, foot to foot, man to man, locked in the melee. But on another sector, where a torrent had scattered about the terrain, rolling boulders and bushes torn up from its banks, Pallas observed his Arcadians turn tail, and the Latins pursuing. The broken ground here had led them for once to dismount from their horses, but they were not accustomed to fighting on foot. So he tried the one thing left him to try in such a grave situation, and sought to revive their morale with a mixture of pleading and harsh rebuke. "Where are you running to, men? I call on you, by your brave deeds, by the name of your king Evander, by the wars we have won, by my own ambition, which now is stirring to rival my father in glory. Don't put any hopes on retreating. We must break our way through the foe with cold steel. There, where they mass against us in greatest numbers, is the route by which our dear country bids you and me to return to her. No gods are after us. We are men, hard-pressed by enemies who also are men, with two hands and mortal lives like us. Look! That great barrier of sea cutting us off, and no room left for flight now. What shall it be, the sea or Troy?" With these words, Pallas hurled himself into the thick of the foe. First to confront him was Lagus, led by unfair fate to the encounter. Him, as he wrenched up a stone of immense weight, Pallas hit with a spear throw, nailing him just where the spine is joined to the ribs on either side. then started to pull out his spear, which was stuck in the bone. His bow, who hoped to get him while he was stooping, failed. As he ran in, full of rage at the bitter death of his comrade, and reckless, Pallas was ready and struck first, burying his sword in the lungs distended with anger. Next he went for Theneus and Anchimolus, a man of Rhetus' ancient line, who had lain with his own stepmother. Larides and Thymba fell too on Italian soil. They were twin brothers, exactly alike, the sons of Dorcas. Their parents could not tell them apart, and with happy affection mistook them. But Pallas now created a dreadful difference between them, for his sword swept off the head of Thymba, while Larides, his severed right hand groped to find its owner, the half-alive fingers twitching, clutching at the sword hilt. The Arcadians, stung by Pallas' rebuke, and witnessing these outstanding feats, now charged at the foe in shame and anger. Then Pallas picked off Rhetus as he whirled past in a two-horse chariot. Ilus won a certain reprieve by that, for Pallas had aimed his strong spear at Ilus from a distance, but Rhetus received it, coming between as he fled from the gallant Teuthras and his brother Tyres. He pitched from the chariot and drummed upon the Italian ground with his heels, dying. Just as, in summertime, when the winds he has prayed for have risen, a shepherd may light fires at intervals over the heathland, all of a sudden the interspaces catch fire, an unbroken line of crackling flame is spread across the broad acres. He sits and reviews the exultant flames like a conqueror. Even so did the brave hearts of Pallas men all rally and weld into one, and they backed him up. But that quick-moving fighter, Halesus, came forward to meet them, crouching tensely behind his shield. He killed Ladon, Pheres, and Demodocus. His flashing sword lopped off the right hand of Strymonius, who was making a thrust at his throat. He struck Thoas in the face with a stone, smashing the skull into fragments spattered with blood and brains. His father, presageful of fate, had hidden Halesus in a forest, but when he was old, near death, his eyes glazing and whitening, the fate spinners laid their hands upon him and made him a victim to Evander's weapons. Pallas now went for Halesus, first praying, "O Father Tiber, grant this spear which I poise to throw good luck. May it find its way through the stubborn heart of Halesus. Your sacred oak shall be graced with the armour I strip from him." The god gave ear to this prayer. Halesus, who was shielding Imaeon, alas uncovered his own breast to Pallas' weapon. But Lausus, who was a major factor in war, allowed no panic amongst his men at Pallas' killings. He first slew Abas, who had been a problem baffling the opposition and holding them up. Many Arcadians went down, and Etruscans, Trojans too, warriors the Greeks had not destroyed. Equal in force and leadership, the armies close. Support troops press up to strengthen the front line, so thick the melee they can hardly move weapon or hand. Here Pallas strains and shoves, here Lausus struggles to meet him. The two are of much the same age, and both uncommonly handsome. But fate has forbidden that they should ever return to their own homelands. The ruler of Great Olympus did not, however, allow these two to confront each other. Their fates await them, how near, at the hands of greater foes. Meanwhile, Turnus was warned by his guardian sister to hurry to Lausus' aid. So he cut through the fray in his speeding chariot. When he got there, he called out, "You can stop fighting now. I am going alone against Pallas. He is my meat, and mine alone. I wish his father was here to witness the duel." He spoke, and his comrades withdrew from the field of battle as bidden. But when the Rutulians moved back, young Pallas, amazed by that arrogant order, stood tongue-tied a moment, surveying the mighty bulk of Turnus, and truculent, looking him up and down at a distance. Then he hurled back these words in the teeth of that haughty prince. "I shall soon be renowned for winning the arms of an enemy general or dying a glorious death. My father can take either. To hell with your threats!" So saying, he moved out into the field. The blood of his Arcadians grew chill, and their hearts numb. Leaping down from his chariot, Turnus prepares for close combat on foot. As a lion who has espied from some high point of vantage, far off on the plain, a bull spoiling for battle, he bounds forward. Yes, that was what Turnus' oncoming looked like. Pallas, as soon as he reckoned his foe was in range of a spear cast, was first to move, hoping that luck would side with one who dared to take on a powerfuller man, and praying thus to high heaven. "Hercules, I implore you, by the welcome my father gave you, the table you shared, though a stranger, help me in this great enterprise. Let Turnus, dying, behold me, strip off his blood-stained armor, and let his closing eyes acknowledge me as his conqueror." Hercules heard the lad. He repressed a terrible groan that rose from deep in his heart, gave way to hopeless tears. Then the Father of Heaven spoke these kindly words to his son. "Every man's hour is appointed, brief and unalterable for all the span of life. To enlarge his fame by great deeds is what the brave man must aim at. Beneath Troy's lofty battlements fell many sons of the gods. Aye, there Sarpedon among them fell, who was my son. Turnus, too, is summoned by his fate, and is nigh to the destined finish of his life." So Jupiter spoke, then averted his eyes from the land of Italy. But Pallas hurled a spear, putting all his strength behind it, and plucked his sword, flashing, out of the hollow scabbard. That skimming spear went home, high up, where shield and armor protect the shoulder, and, actually piercing the rim of the shield, just managed to graze in the end the mighty body of Turnus. Turnus now gave himself plenty of time to poise and aim at Pallas his steel-tipped oaken spear. As he threw it, he shouted, "Watch out, and see if my spear does not go deeper than his went." Pallas' shield, for all its layers of iron and bronze, for all the protective layers of bull's hide that reinforced it, was broken through in the center by the impact of Turnus' quivering spear point, which drove on to pierce the breastplate and then the breast. Pallas wrenched out the weapon warm from the wound. It was no good. His blood and his life ebbed through the same channel at once. Hunched over the wound, he fell, his armor clanging above him, fell with his bleeding mouth to the enemy soil, dying. Turnus straddled above him and spoke. "Remember well what I say, you Arcadians, and tell your king I send him back his Pallas, a dead man. Evander deserved it. What compensation there is in a tomb, what comfort in burial, he can have. He'll find he has paid dear enough for making friends with Aeneas." So saying, he pressed his left foot hard on the back of the corpse, and tore off the sword belt, a thing of immense weight, engraved with a legendary crime, that family of brothers foully murdered upon their wedding night, the bedchambers swimming in blood. Eurytus' son, Clonus, had worked it in rich gold chasing. This belt was now taken by Turnus for spoils, and delighted his heart. Ah, mind of man, so ignorant of fate, of what shall befall him, so weak to preserve moderation when riding the crest of good fortune. For Turnus, a time is coming when he'd give anything to have left Pallas unharmed, and will loathe this day and the spoils it brought him. But Pallas' comrades clustered around him, laid his corpse on a shield and bore it away, lamenting and weeping. What grief, what pride his father would feel at his homecoming. Today had been his baptism in war. Today his end. Still, he had left behind him a trail of Italian dead. This calamity came to the ears of Aeneas now, not as a rumor, but through an official message to tell him his allies were right on the brink of disaster, were broken and needed succor immediately. Mowing down all who stood in his way, like a demon he carved out a broad swathe with his sword through the foe. His objective was Turnus, insolent from his last killing. He seemed to see Pallas, Evander, the banquet, the first he'd been welcomed to here in this land as a stranger, the hands he had clasped, to see them before him. So now he captured alive 4 warrior sons of Sulmo, and 4 whom Ufens had reared, designing to sacrifice them to the ghost of Pallas and sprinkle his funeral pyre with the blood of these captive youths. Next, in his anger, he tried a long spear shot at Magus, who ducked adroitly, so that the vibrant projectile flew over him, then, clutching the knees of the Trojan, babbled out prayers for mercy. By the shade of your sire, and by all your hopes for Ascanius' future, I implore you, don't kill me. Preserve me for my son's sake and my father's. There's a fine palace, it's mine, and deep below it are buried talents of chaste silver. I've plenty of gold, too, wrought and unwrought gold. The Trojans don't have to depend upon killing me to win the day. One life will not make any difference. Magus had spoken. Aeneas gave him his answer thus. Those many talents of silver and gold you tell me about, keep them for your children. Such courteous bargains in war, Turnus was first to abjure. Just now, when he killed Pallas, that's what my father Anchises thinks, and my son Ascanius. So saying, Aeneas gripped the man's helmet in his left hand, bent his head back while he pleaded, and drove the sword home in his throat, up to the hilt. Nearby was Haemon's son, a priest of Apollo and Trivia, wearing the wreath and sacred headband, resplendent from head to foot in his dress and distinctive accoutrements. Him did Aeneas meet on the field, send flying and strike down. Then, standing over him, killed him, pawed him in darkness. Serestus collected and bore off the dead man's arms as a trophy for Mars. Now the enemy ranks were stiffened by Siculus, a man of Vulcan's line, and by Umbro, who came from the Marcian hills. Aeneas stormed against them. His sword lopped off the left arm of Anxur, and with that arm the round shield fell to the ground. Anxur had just said something big, thinking his prowess would equal his boasting. Maybe he was building castles in the air, and had seen every prospect of living to a ripe old age. Next moment, in glittering armour, Tarquitus bounded forth, the son of the nymph Dryope by Faunus, lord of the woodlands, and stood in the path of the raging Aeneas, who, drawing his spear back, pinned Tarquitus' ponderous shield to his corslet with a thrust. Then, as he begged for mercy, uselessly babbling, Aeneas struck off his head, sent it rolling, and pushing away the still warm trunk of the man, stood above it, saying these pitiless words. Lie there, you terrible warrior. Your lady mother shall never inter you. Commit your remains to the tomb of your ancestors. You're for the carrion birds, or else you'll be chucked in the sea for the waves to dispose of, the hungry fishes to suck your wounds. At once he went in chase of Antaeus and Lucas, front rank soldiers.